there would be interaction. There would be essentially no interaction between all of those things, unless one of them had a whopping big signal generator, a whopping big local oscillator that was being roared into one of those directional coupler lines. With the exception of that, they would all be thoroughly independent. So you could make this one piece of pipe give you all of the test equipment connections you want simultaneously. I wonder if you see the process of that. I think I already sent you a copy of that directional coupler article I wrote a few years ago, John. KC2WGB to take it. Before I send it to you, once again, you guys who listen to all of this jazz going on in the background, please go to the reverse mode on your rig, 146.25, listening, and tell us what you hear during the time that jamming is being attempted, how strong, what time did you hear it, and please report it to RFI at limog.org. KC2WGB, K2IW the Tech Mask.
Also tell them to include their location.
WD2HWW, you want to comment?
Go ahead, Howie.
You were packed in and Bert make a 50 dB tap, an inline tap to allow you to go from 10 megs to a gig. I've used those. You put them in line and you can hook a service monitor up and check the signal. Then you can be 50, 60 dB down. So let's say you want to have a, you have a couple hundred watt transmitter and you want to put something sensitive. It's a 50 dB tap.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Howie. We heard everything you said, Howie. The tapping device that Howie is talking about is this very simple device often used by people using a service monitor, which has a movable probe. It's a non-directional coupler. It's a sampling device. And by changing the probe length, how close it comes to the center conductor, it can allow you to act it, make it act like a 30, 40, 50, 60 dB sampling device. And that's also, you don't necessarily have to have a directional coupler. It can be a non-directional coupler. So that sampling device that allows you to measure sensitivity, desense capability of a repeater with a service monitor is very popular. By the way, Howie, nice loud signal you've got. Your audio is a tiny bit heavy, but good clean audio, a little heavy, and lots of RF you gave us. So I think some of those hints will help you, John. And you may have to talk over top of this jazz that you're hearing in the background. KC2WGB, K2LAW, the Tech Man.
KC2WGB, I hope you can hear me too. Yeah, great information, and that's very similar. What Howie just mentioned, very similar. You could use a slotted line with the probe that will advance its depth and the basic feed. It'll give you the same thing. Very interesting. Okay, I'll kick it back to you, and very good response. KC2WGB.
Yeah, the only slight difficulty you're going to have with the slotted line, John, is that the probe on it and the usual setup has in there a diode detector, and it's made to give you a envelope detected RF signal with a 1KC modulation on it that goes to the Hewlett-Packard standing wave ratio indicator, which really is looking at a video signal of a 1 kilohertz square wave, sine wave, whatever, and it's got a diode detector. You may have to do some modifying of that probe on a slotted line in order to make it an RF detecting device. It has a built-in detector and RF bypass, if you know what I mean, making life a little bit more difficult. But if you were to homebrew things along those lines, you'd be amazed how easy that is to do with some simple mechanical engineering. To my knowledge, we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in with a question tonight. So I think it's time to go over to the mailbag. It's almost the right time, that John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the Tech Net.
Dick, can I, would I be out of line asking something real quick? MCO.
Yeah, go ahead, John. Here we go, Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
Gaian telescope, as you mentioned. You know, right now I can't get out of the house. I had a lady, a very nice lady that works for me. Her English is fair. She's... copy of Sky and Telescope magazine. That's the first thing. The other thing, what Paul mentioned, is what I want to do. What Paul said, I want to look at the moons of Jupiter. I want to look at the rings of Saturn. You know, simple things to start off with. Back to you, Dick, N2EO.
Now, Sky and Telescope magazine, any good newsstand, Barnes & Noble, among others, Borders Bookstore, if it still exists, almost every single month they'll have on the stand a issue of Sky and Telescope magazine. Also, another very good magazine that gives you a lot of information is Astronomy Magazine. And the thing that's amazing to me is that Sky and Telescope has been around for 150 years. Astronomy Magazine, I think, has been around for around 15 years. Arguably, Astronomy Magazine is, to some degree, a little bit more fun to read, a little bit better pictures, and slightly more easy-to-read articles. Maybe you want both magazines, so pick up a copy of Astronomy and a copy of Sky and Telescope. And whether or not you get into a subscription on those is something worth considering. However, when it comes to selecting your first telescope and getting hints and tings as to how to do that, and whether or not it should be binoculars or telescope, let me drop them. There, you have to go to the Sky and Telescope website, which I think is skyandtelescope.org or .com, but you Google the word Sky and Telescope, you'll find it real fast. Their website has two or three articles about selecting your first telescope. That you're not going to find in the magazine. Oh, maybe once every 10 years they'll have an article in the magazine on that subject. And they also have the so-called astronomy, the amateur telescope makers page is in every issue of Sky and Telescope, where you see guys that have home-brewed really elaborate high-performance telescopes. That's a little bit beyond what you want to get involved in at first. These are the guys that show up at Stellafane and demonstrate to each other how much optical skill they've got at building very sophisticated equipment with simple homebrew tools, if you know what I mean, the amateur telescope makers page. So you want to go to the website when it comes to selecting and read that. It'll give you some hints. That and talking to your friends help you select the first, second, and third telescope that you're going to buy. And should it be used or new, a bunch of decisions like that. It's not too different than selecting your first ham radio rig. Once again, all that noise you're hearing in the background, please listen on the input. Tell us what you hear, what time you heard it, what direction it seemed to be coming from. When you listen to 146.25, the reverse button on your rig, and report that to rfi@limearc.org. And I have no trouble hearing you over top of the sound, John. I'm hearing you also on the input. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, John.
Dick?
Go ahead, Eric.
Please mention to have them include their location, their QTA, because we get stuff and we don't know where they are.
That's a good idea. Well, by way of their call letters, you've got a very strong hint as to where they're located, but yes.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, so just to be double down sure, when you give us those reports of what you're hearing on the input, tell us where you were located at the time, what time you heard it, how strong it was, where you were located at the time. If you were away from your QTH, you might be in a mobile rig, so to speak. So let us know where the report came from. So John, go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
T2WGB. Okay, Dick, I hope you're hearing me all right. Have an antenna question here. It's for 20 and 40 meters. It's a horizontal dipole. As it's orientated north southwest, wants to know, can you change the antenna for gravity? He cannot rotate the antenna, and he wants to go a little more north. Sort of like this and other methods and so forth.
20 and 40 meters dipole, goes from northeast to southwest, and he wants to favor more north. And he cannot move the dipole itself. And he doesn't have the ability to put up a second chunk of wire. Wire is something that the public doesn't see. And so if you're a serious ham radio operator, you're going to fill up the sky in your backyard with wires going north, south, east, west, and so on. However, one nice thing to know about a dipole is ordinarily it radiates broadside. So a dipole that is northeast, southwest is going to favor northwest and southeast, if you know what I mean, is the broadside directions. Or horizontal polarization when the dipole is parallel to the ground. If you're willing to slant the dipole, make it a sloper. As you start approaching vertical polarization, the null off the ends of the wire disappears. If you made it a sloper, or if you really had a high enough tree that you could make the dipole purely vertical, you would cover all directions of the compass simultaneously. But a sloper going from northeast to the southwest, and whether you slope the low end toward the northeast or the low end toward the southwest, that's your choice. That doesn't matter. Let me drop. That's your choice. But as you start vertically sloping it, like I'm describing, higher at one end, lower at the other end, in altitude above the ground, you're now starting to pick up vertical polarization in all directions. And the sloper almost doesn't have a directional iron characteristic to it. As you make that slope angle closer and closer to vertical, you're becoming closer and closer to an omnidirectional antenna. So that's the easiest approach. And you can go halfway in between by maybe not sloping the whole antenna, but sloping the ends of the antenna down. As you start developing more and more wire that is partially vertically polarized, you'll be favoring those directions off the end of the dipole where normally there is a null, and that null will start filling in real fast as you start adding vertical wire. In fact, you could even consider, no, that's about the best suggestion I could make on that one, John, and there's nothing stopping you from making a fan dipole that is a sloper. I've never seen that combination in the books, but it's about time that somebody go and do that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
John?
Okay.
Hello?
At least that gives him a direction to go in. So I would recommend that he can raise the north end at first and see how that works for him. And I would like to see him get better than 45 degrees, but I don't know if he has that height available. And if he was raising the northeast end, what is the lowest point he could place the southwest to use him?
He could make the low end that's closest to the ground almost touch the ground if he wanted to. He will be adding some extra capacitance to that end. Therefore, the antenna will slightly tune itself to a lower frequency. If he's got a broad enough tuning range of his antenna tuner, you can easily accommodate that. Or you can compensate by making the wire of the dipole a little bit shorter. So the end that's closest to the ground adds capacitance, tunes it to a slightly lower frequency. By bringing the wire a little bit shorter, you'll bring that back. So you could bring it all the way down to the ground. I wouldn't go and touch the ground because the only problem with that is now as the wire gets super close to the ground, even though it's a high voltage point, it still will be coupling a little bit of energy into that volumetric lossy material called ground or dirt, and you're going to lose a little bit of the power. Not much, a fraction of a dB. So you've got a lot of freedom on this one. And you could even run a series of experiments where the high end is on a set of pulleys, and as you pull on the ropes, you can change the altitude of the high end or low end, and find out at which tilt angle do you get the best performance toward the particular direction you're trying to experiment with. As you can tell, antenna experimenting is where we amateurs really shine. It's where a lot of good things can happen. And putting up other wires, even though he thinks he doesn't have the ability to rotate that, guarantee somewhere on the property there is a piece of one tree that's high on one end. I mean, the direction he's not covering very well is north northwest, southeast. One of those directions is going to have a tree, a telephone pole, a flag pole, something. Let me drop. One of those directions is going to have something he can hang one end of a slope or two, and the other end can come all the way down to the ground, so to speak, by way of an extra piece of rope to a stake from the egg insulator. And so he can set up antennas in multiple directions in his backyard, guaranteed. Almost everybody can hear. Time to go over to the next one, John. And I'm hearing you very well in the input, so don't worry. And I'll repeat what doesn't come through. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the tech net.
Coil by bringing a piece of ferrite material near the coil.
The brass lug, by comparison, tends to short out magnetic fields. Let me drop. The shorting out of magnetic field is a fancy way of saying it will tune your resonating structure to a higher frequency. So quite often this kind of a tuning tool I'm describing is a brass lug on one end, a ferrite plug on the other end. So by plugging in the brass lug, you move the resonator up the frequency and you make a decision that it's better or worse. Then you reverse the tool, bring the ferrite plug near the resonator, and it goes down in frequency. You make a decision whether it's better or worse. A little bit similar to what the eye doctor does. He'll give you a slightly higher corrective lens or a slightly lower corrective lens, and he flips the two back and forth and asks you which is better when you're looking at the eye chart. Or he rotates one of them, which is adjusting the astigmatism. You try to choose the right amount of astigmatism adjustment and the right angle of it. And I almost always ask for, can I rotate the knob so that I can find that peak, rather than have him rotate it a random amount and he asks me, is it better or worse? If I'm tuning it myself, I can really find out where is the peak in performance. Well, by the same token, as you bring the brass plug or the ferrite plug closer and further away, not only is it moving it in a predictable direction, moving the frequency of resonance up or down, but as you bring it closer or further away, you're changing the magnitude by which it moves it up or down. That's the second kind of tuning tool. Let me drop this another one. The other kind of tuning tool is the one that I used a whole lot when it comes to VHF antennas. If I'm tuning a 900 megacycle, 915, 902 megacycle antenna, I had a whole series of long plastic skewers, the long plastic wooden, here we go, wooden skewers, the kind of things you can buy in a grocery store. These are sticks that are about an eighth inch in diameter, and they come about a foot or so long, and you put a small piece of copper tape on the end of this thing. Maybe it's a one inch square, and I had some of them that were a half inch square, one inch square, two inch square, and so on. As you bring those pieces of copper tape near the tip of a dipole or near the tip of a parasitic resonator, a director or reflector of the antenna, as you bring that piece of copper foil, which is sitting up in air, held at the end of this wooden stick, and you're standing out of the field, back a foot or two away, as you bring it near the tip of a dipole or a director, the extra capacitance you're adding to the tip of the director, we'll say, brings it to a lower frequency. Now you're watching your instrumentation, and did the gain go up or go down? Did the visual go up or go down as you bring it closer? So it goes lower in frequency as you bring a copper tape closer to the tip. And again, you know what direction it's moving in, how close you move it, that tells you how much you're going to move in that direction. Now if you start off with a large enough piece of copper tape, like a 2-inch square, and you hold it near center, let me drop. You hold that near the center of your director or driven element. The presence of the large sheet of copper on this piece of wooden stick gives you a partial magnetic shunt of the magnetic field that's in the center of your dipole-like device or director. That moves it up in frequency. So a large piece of copper held near the center of a director moves it up in frequency. A small piece of copper held near the tip of a director moves it down in frequency. So now, you don't have to unplug each one of these directors and plug in one of longer or shorter length. You can do that electronically by holding these so-called tuning wands, I call them, of various kinds, near the center or near the tip. So there's lots and lots of ways of probing nearby fields of resonators and dipoles and directors and reflectors, and you can get a zillion experiments in moving those resonators up and down in frequency, finding out real fast which way the antenna wants to go to give you better performance. You can do 50 of these experiments in an hour, if you know what I mean, and you try to computer model that, and each time you plug in all that data and press go on the computer model, you wait a half hour for an answer. You can get an answer every 10 seconds as by watching the screen as you use these tuning wands and tuning tools. The smart amateurs have gotten a lot faster, better way of doing it. Gee, KQRIW-GB, KQRIW in the SecNet.
Let me stop you guys for a second. I'm going to make some changes.
Stand by.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
All right, Dave, keep going. Roger, Dodger, Paul. And I'm pretty sure you've enabled the eastern link, and most likely when we go over to Paul in a few minutes, that's going to be his best way of getting in by way of 147.375. Okay, John. We've got the time for you to go to one or two more, at least, from your mailbag. And I wonder if it's approximately what you believe the guy was looking for with reference to tuning tools and tuning wands. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the SecNet.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
There was that automatic FFDNA.
I delaw token act off. I delaw token act off.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear. An error has occurred.
Take straight up.
Okay, you said straight up. Oh, sure enough, working like a chump. Looks like to some degree we go back to quasi-normal, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, and please go on with one or two more of your mailbag, giving us more time to tune up everything also. not downstairs. That's disconnected right now. Go back to the normal operation for the time being, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Going from
roughly 4.5 or 5 kc of deviation down to 2.5 kc of deviation. They've made the amplitude of the FM sideband 6 decibels weaker. In other words, it's a hell of a lot. Let me drop
26 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
In other words, there is 6 dB less real transmitted audio on these narrowband systems. As such, the signal-to-noise ratio you're going to get out is not going to be as good. The amount of intermodulation distortion is going to be worse. They think they're going to pack more signals in. I think this is going to be an experiment that on paper sounds good. I don't think it was well researched. I don't think it was well tried out in the real environment of where you've got so-called near-far signals. In other words, you've got some signals that are tremendously strong, local, some signals that are weak and far away, and they're all being mixed together into a real receiver in a real metropolitan location. Under those conditions, this narrowband packing in more signals closer, and you think you're getting more customers per megacycle, I think they're going to slowly discover that it's a bust instead of a boon. I don't think it's going to work well. I think it's a bad move. Lots of people are being forced to install a whole lot of new equipment, buying new transmitters and receivers, setting up new base stations and whatever. A hell of a lot of investment is being made, and I think there's a 50-50 chance it's going to become a boondoggle. That's an opinion on my part. I hope I'm wrong, but you can see what I'm worried about. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. That's unfortunate, Dick, because I don't think if it becomes a boondoggle, there's area for correction. Now you got manufacturers that are manufacturing the stuff, and as you said, we have installers, companies spending millions of dollars. Wow, this could be a boondoggle. Okay, well, that's about it from the mail, Dick.
2, weaker, transmit.
We do a lot of these, Dick.
So, you know, you want to comment?
Back to you, Dick, and on to Paul.
Okay, John, WW, we're hearing you pretty well. Make sure you're not hitting the audio too hard there, and give us your comment. HWW, KQRIW, go ahead, Howie.
To second exactly what you're saying, what the FCC is doing, forget about the digital, forcing everybody to go to 2.5 KC or digital, they are really making a lot of systems sound crappy. Just listen to the police. I think 5 KC is good, better than being 15. I think 15 was better, but 5 is very nice. You get a 1.6 modulation index. I mean, we can go into that, and you know what I'm talking about. The the maximum deviation divided by the maximum frequency that you're trying to put through. And now they're going to 2.5 KC, and it sounds very muddy, and what people are doing using all kinds of commanders and stuff. I absolutely agree with what you commented on.
Yeah, sounds like your experiments are similar to mine, Howie. The narrower deviation gives you a hell of a lot less audio that's really being transmitted. The FM improvement ratio is terrible. It doesn't sound that good. Speech intelligibility is darn important when it comes to vital communication for law enforcement, fire, police, emergency vehicles, and so on. On top of that, many of these digital systems that are being sold on paper look good. You think you're getting extra security and other people are not listening. Well, there's an awful lot of horror stories of a fireman is in the basement of a building, things come crushing down on him, he's in a bad location where the radio is not giving him, the digital radio is not giving him the coverage he wants. He goes over to the local simplex mode, he starts shouting Mayday, and nobody hears him. Whereas at least when you had the old non-digital system, analog audio, at least people with scanners stood a chance of hearing that guy hollering Mayday, and even if the guys on the scene are not listening to the second frequency, the simplex frequency, so to speak, at least somebody with a scanner can say, hey, this is what I heard, you got a guy in the basement who's hollering Mayday, you really got to go rescue him. There's a hell of a lot of fallback procedures that are not being properly considered when it comes to these digital techniques. You take, for instance, an example of what happened in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. Let me drop. They were talked into an 800 megacycle quasi-digital system, which hadn't been tried out very well. The bugs hadn't been arranged out of it. Because the 800 megs had nowhere near as much coverage as the 400 megs or 150 megs that we were using earlier, they needed more towers in order to get proper coverage. They didn't have it. The equipment they were sold didn't have enough backup to it. But they weren't given a recharger, a charging network that could plug into the cigarette lighter of the police car to charge their handy-talkies. The handy-talkies all had to be recharged back at the police station. Well, the police station lost power, and even their generator went underwater, so they couldn't charge handy-talkies. The bottom line was you have a bunch of law enforcement people in the field with no operating radio. That is their main lifeline back to other law enforcement people, back to headquarters. It is their lifeline. You put a policeman out in the field in a dangerous environment, and he doesn't have a radio where he can holler Mayday. Very rapidly, he says, I've got a family. I don't want to put my life at risk. Eventually, he abandons his post. He abandons his town, and sometimes he will abandon his state. And they had that kind of jazz going on in New Orleans. That radio system was not very well thought out. The main backup there was a telephone circuit, and the telephone base stations and the cell sites had also failed simultaneously. The real communication, what little bit there was ham radio operators. So you got to really think twice before, let me drop it. If you're a law enforcement, emergency vehicles or whatever, and you're being talked into a new whiz-bang radio system on 800 megs versus the old-fashioned 400 megs or the old-fashioned 150 megs, and you think you're going to get better coverage, better reliability, and less interference, and less other people listening, and more private conversation, you think on paper you're getting all of these advantages. You better go slow before you write that great big check to install that whole system in your particular town, in your particular county, because there's a lot of horror stories. You better check real fast how many people have had that exact system. What is their track record? Are they happy with it? Is it a brand new system where you're buying serial number one? You better go slow, because there's lots of horror stories out there, and I've heard some of them. Okay, so we've run out of mailbag for the time being, and it's time to go over to space. And Paul, WS2N, tell us what is National Aeronautics and Space Administration been doing lately. And I think you keep correcting me. It's not 120 astronomical units. I think it's 125 astronomical units where Voyager is out there at something like 8. Something like 8 billion miles. You keep correcting me on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2IW in the tech man.
Okay, yeah, boys, you wanted 127 and a quarter AU. So that's out there. The other one, I think, is up to 107 or something like that. So Voyager 2 is behind, but it's out there. That's probably a couple of years from going the same point where Voyager 1 is interstellar space. So, very good. First of all, Dick, this is WS2N, how am I making?
You're sounding quite good, Paul. By method you're getting in, the voice is a little bit high-pitched, but that gives us good intelligibility. So some of the bass notes are missing, but you sound good. Please proceed. WS2N, K2IW.
Okay, very good. Well, we're into 2014. We're up to the 10th anniversary of the two Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Spirit quit working on 2010, but Opportunity is still rolling along over 10 years. Spirit went about, what, a little over 4 or 5 miles to Columbia Hills. Out of the 5 miles, the last mile or so was with a wheel that wasn't operating. First rover to ever climb a mountain on another planet. 125,000 pictures came from Spirit alone. Countless going over to rocks, grinding off the rind of the rocks, community is still doing it. Fantastic pictures. You go to the website and look at the pictures that Spirit had an opportunity of taking. It's really something to look at. All the panoramic views, and if you have the 3D glasses, you can look at some of the 3D pictures as well. Let me drop it. We were launched by a Delta rocket. Took them about 8 months to get there. And remember, these were the two that went flying through the atmosphere with their... Oh, yeah, they had parachutes, but toward the end, they were encased with giant airbags that blew up with nitrogen charges. They bounced a mile or two on the surface and then rolled to a stop, deflated the bags, opened up the pedal-like doors, the whole thing opened up, and inside was the rover. And the rovers rolled down the ramp. You remember, they were sent a couple of weeks apart, so one landed on the third, the other one, opportunity was a couple of weeks later, on that January 10 years ago. We drop it. Well, Curiosity's going to have to do a lot to keep up with the odometers on these things. Like I said, Spirit was about almost 5 miles. Opportunity, I went for long rides, went to the Victoria Crater, now it's the Endurance Crater. These are very, very long drives. Over 25 miles now, about 25 miles on the Opportunity rover. And the word Curiosity has been there a little over a year, and that's been about a mile and probably a little over a mile, maybe a mile and a quarter. So looking forward to it, maybe another 10 years of Curiosity. Who knows how long Opportunity might be in the running. It's still got 300 some odd watts of power last time I looked to use on that 400 pound go-kart size lander. Now to talk about that 10 year anniversary is pretty important for those two rovers at this WS Twin. Off to date, we'll go to a week or so ago of the launch of Gaia. Gaia is a telescope built by and put up by the European Space Agency. Was launched from French Guiana, South America, or a launching facility, and launched with a Soyuz rocket. Now, the Russians don't have anything to do with this. The European Space Agency is actually buying their rockets. This is the sixth one that has been conditioned by the European Space Agency and brought over to French Guiana to be launched. They're launching basically three main big rockets in French Guiana. Soyuz, and then there's the Ariane 5, which is going quite well. That launches about 10 times the weight of the Soyuz. And then the lighter version, which they just started a year or so ago, called the Vega rocket. So they have basically three launch vehicles. They're not competing against each other. They just have different payloads that they can launch. So now the Gaia spacecraft, what's that? That's a space telescope. And they've been working on that thing in Europe. Measure the location and the distances of all these stars, it's only a small portion of the Milky Way, of course. The Milky Way has about 100 to 200 billion stars, so it's, let's call it 1/100th of the Milky Way that they're going to map out to precise measurements, locations, speeds that are quarter away from each other, and distances from the Earth. So this is an extension of a previous mission years ago that they had. Now to do this, they have instruments on board. Their camera consists of 1 billion pixels. Hubble went flying up there in 1990 with 5 million pixels. Now it's got 1 billion pixels on board. To do this work, a couple of other imaging there, piece of equipment as well. Now Gaia is let's call it a Canamite spacecraft. But unlike Hubble, where you have an aperture, you know, you have like a long tube, have one end, you have your aperture. Their aperture comes out the side of the spacecraft. And so light is actually going inside, and it's spinning. And because it's spinning, it's going to eventually take pictures of 360 degrees all the way around it. And to do this right, they need to be away from all kinds of light. So where are they going to put this thing? Now, it's on flight now. It should get there in about a week. It's going to the L2 position, the Lagrange 2 point. Lagrange 1 being between Earth and Sun. Lagrange 2, Lagrange point 2 is past the Earth. So you got Sun, Earth, and Lagrange point 2. And 1 million miles out. That's the same place where eventually the James Webb Space Telescope will be located. So, interesting telescope being put up. It's also going to do a lot of work that Kepler launched by the United States years ago, which has all the problems with the momentum wheels not working properly, knocking that out of the running, it looks like. But even so, Kepler has confirmed, I've read 165 planets and many more to be confirmed. This Gaia thing is going to possibly confirm thousands of planets. So, between the European Space Agency and the United States and our allies are involved with our telescopes, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to be learned in the next couple of years. Now, that's 5-year missions, possibly, you know, extended missions as well. It does have a big sunshade behind it, so that reminds me a little bit about the James Webb Space Telescope. It's got a big, maybe 20-foot diameter type sunshade put behind the telescope. Of course, that's going to be relatively small compared to the tennis size, court size sunshade that the James Webb Space Telescope is going to have. So I just want to bring up those basically two rare things, the 10-year missions of the Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars, as well as the something new, the Gaia Space Telescope launched about a week or so ago to be put on Lagrange Point 2 in about a week from now. Back to you, Dick. WS2N for any questions.
Fantastic. That Gaia, 5-year mission, and I think you said it's going to find, it's likely to find a few thousand exoplanets. And how soon is that going to be launched is question number one. Also, when it comes to the James Webb Space Telescope, this is that huge infrared telescope that's going to be put, I believe, at Lagrange Point number 2, the one that's a million miles away from Earth, on the opposite side from the Sun. I think I have seen an advertisement in the last week or so that PBS is going to have a special
describing James Webb. I think it's going to be a Nova or Nova Science now. That's something to look forward to. I think that's coming up pretty soon. But once again, how soon is Gaia going to be launched? So give me a bit of a repeat on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, yeah, Gaia was launched. G-I-A-I. It's back in the old Carl Sagan book that was named for Earth, you know. Old world name for Earth. One of those mythology books. But, it's not really named after the place that it was launched from, which is French Guiana. That's about completely different. But, Gaia was launched on the 19th of December, so it's up there. It was launched by a Soyuz spacecraft, Soyuz rocket from French Guiana. The Astrion is a company that deals with European Space Agency, and they've contracted with Russia to actually buy some of their rockets and float them over to French Guiana, put them together over there, and launch them. And this is the sixth one, number six, which, so they've just started doing this in the last 2 years, launching Soyuz rockets. And that went up successfully. They have a YouTube on it. If you look up Gaia or YouTube launch, it's from French Guiana. They show the foreign speaking people keep doing the countdown, and it's pretty cool. They had a nice day launch. So that's up there. It's going to take roughly 3 weeks or so to get to Lagrange Point 2, which is about another week from now, I guess. It's going to the same location that James Webb or Herschel or the Planck, that's a popular place for putting a space telescope. Back to you.
Well done. So Planck went there, which I think was the successor to I keep forgetting the name of the darn thing. Kobe, and what came after Kobe?
WMF. Wilkinson. And you know how to pronounce the rest. Thank you.
The Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. Anisotropy means non-isotropic. In other words, the difference between isotropic. 2.73 degrees Kelvin is the background temperature of free space left over from the Big Bang. That's what Penzias and Wilson measured way back in 1968 at Bell Laboratories, Homedale, New Jersey, with that great big Hoghorn steerable antenna, where they had to sweep out all the bird droppings because they thought that was creating the extra noise at first, and they got a Nobel Prize for that one. All right, so they made the first measurement of the 2.73 degrees, and that's the rounded off number. But if you can measure with a very accurate radiometer, let me drop.
Comment six.
Okay, John, here we go, Paul. You measure with a very accurate radiometer where you can resolve millikelvins and microkelvins of temperature difference. You find what they call hot spots, not even mildly warm spots.